morning, everybody. How's it going out there? I'm so glad that I am here today on Amy's Kids Show. We have another special show planned for today. We have some good music, and also we're going to do a little traveling. So, in fact, instead of good morning, I should probably say dobre utro. I'm trying to learn a new language here. We're going to be rushing around Russia today. So I have some Russian music, and we're going to learn a few words in Russian if we pay close attention. I've been trying to pay close attention to these Russian words because we are going to go to another continent today to learn a little bit about what it's like to grow up in Russia, or what it was like to grow up in Russia a little while ago. I don't believe it's quite like this now, but there is a very interesting book that I'm going to share with you today. It's written by Eugene Yelchin, and it's called, get this, The Genius Under the Table. Growing up behind the Iron Curtain. The Genius Under the Table. And this book is written for probably middle schoolers, high schoolers, although I'm an adult and I've really enjoyed it. And I'm pretty sure the little kids will like some of the bits too. There's going to be some bubble gum involved. Bubble gum? Do you like chewing gum? Does anybody out there like to chew gum? Well, it turns out that when Eugene Yelchin, the author, was growing up in Russia, there wasn't any bubblegum around. Yeah, so part of the story is where he gets to try his first piece of bubblegum that an American sneaks into him and his brother. It's pretty interesting story. And part of it is that Eugene, when he was growing up there, you know, apparently spent some time under the table, under his family's table, their dining room table. Has anybody been spending time at their dining room table lately? Maybe some of you have, and have you ever spent time under the dining room table? I actually had some kids under the table just the other day. So it's really interesting that this comes up again, because the story is called The Genius Under the Table. So Eugene started drawing pictures under the table, which is where he slept with his family because they all sleep in one room. And that's how he got to be so good at drawing, which is how he came to draw the roosters in the story that we read a few weeks ago about the rooster who wouldn't stop singing. So, because I found that wonderful artist in that wonderful rooster book, I also found this wonderful book that I'm going to share with you today. Thank you for joining me. Let's have some gratitude.
I'm going to sit at the welcome table. Sit at the welcome table one of these days. Hallelujah. I'm gonna sit at the welcome table. Sit at the welcome table one of these days. One of these days.
Milk and honey, one of these days. God's children gonna sit together.
Yes.
All God's children gonna sit together one of these days. Hallelujah. All God's children gonna
sit together.
All God's children gonna sit together one of these days.
That everybody knows. They moved their business out of town, but not everybody goes. And sometimes we have trouble when it's time to pay the rent. And sometimes I get hungry 'cause all the money's spent. To the land of opportunity came my mother, me, and dad. We were looking for a better life than the kind of life we had. And sometimes we have trouble 'cause we get so little pay. And sometimes I get hungry 'cause we eat one meal a day. And the hand that opens empty is difficult to hear. Above the noises of our lives, though it may be very near. Someday it may be your hand, someday it may be mine. We all must keep on listening to hear that hand in time. I'll hold that hand in mine. I like to go and visit James when he's feeling up to it. It's hard just living every day, but he doesn't want to quit. And sometimes he has trouble 'cause it costs so much to live. And sometimes he gets hungry and something's gotta give. And the hand that opens empty is difficult to hear. Above the noises of our lives, though it may be very near. Someday it may be your hand, someday it may be mine. We all must keep on listening to hear that hand in time. I'll hold that hand in mine. There's a woman in our neighborhood, her family's grown and gone. alone in her living room. The curtains are all drawn, and sometimes she has trouble, 'cause it's hard to get around. Sometimes she gets hungry and she can't get downtown. And the hand that opens empty is difficult to hear. Above the noises of our lives, though it may be very near. Someday it may be your hand, someday it may be mine. We all must keep on listening to hear that hand in time. I'll hold that hand in mine. I'll hold that hand in mine. I'll hold that hand in mine.
There are seven, there are seven continents, continents. Europe, Asia, Africa, North and South America, Australia, Antarctica. There are seven, there are seven continents, continents. Europe, Asia, Africa, North and South America, Australia, Antarctica. There are seven, there are seven continents, continents. Europe, Asia, Africa, North and South America, Australia, Antarctica. There are seven, there are seven continents, continents. Europe, Asia, Africa, North and South America, Australia, Antarctica, Australia, Antarctica, Australia, Antarctica, Australia, Antarctica, Australia, Antarctica.
We were rushing around in Russia, but we stopped to say hello. Доброе утро, good morning. Доброе утро, good morning. Then we were soon on the go. We were rushing around in Russia during the middle of the day. Добрый день, good afternoon. Добрый день, good afternoon. Then we hurried on our way. We were rushing around in Russia during a star-filled night. Добрый вечер, good evening. Добрый вечер, good evening. Then we were quickly out of sight.
Lullaby.
folks. We have been rushing around Russia already and traveling the seven continents because we have to travel from North America, where I am right now, over to Russia, which is over in Asia. And so we're going to be traveling around the world here. And the reason why we're traveling is because here on Amy's Kids Show, we have been celebrating abundance. And abundance is when there is more than enough for everybody to share. And there really is more than enough of everything for everybody to share. But still, it's weird and sort of sad because still, even though there's an abundance, people struggle on all seven continents to have enough to eat, sometimes to have a nice place to live, right? It's a struggle, and not everybody has all those things. So on Amy's Kids Show, we're going to kind of learn a little bit about maybe why. And over in Russia, when the author of the book we're going to read today, Eugene Yelchin, when he was growing up in Russia, they were not allowed to ask any questions. They were not allowed to choose where they lived or where they worked. And so they were not able to make anything better for their families. And whatever they were supposed to do, they tried to do so that they wouldn't get in trouble. Because there were spies everywhere. Do you guys know what spies are? Have you ever heard of a spy movie, right? Or a spy book? Spies are people who watch other people to keep an eye on them, often in order to get them in trouble. And so there are spies in the story. There's bubblegum also. There are some wild-looking Americans who come to brighten up the square. And then there's Lenin, who is the former leader of this country, the leader who made the country the way that it is in the story, where they can't ask questions, they can't choose where they live. And even though Lenin, in the story here, the Lenin has passed away. He died quite a while ago, but it is considered respectful to go and visit his mummy. So that's kind of where we're starting out here. And this book is written for children, for young middle schoolers probably, and high schoolers. And so here we go. It's called The Genius Under the Table. The first time I saw real American tourists. They hopped out of a tourist bus in Red Square in Moscow and cut in line in front of us. "Nice manners," my mother shouted. "We've been freezing our butts off for hours and they just breeze in like that." We were in line to the mausoleum where the founder of our country, Vladimir I. Lenin, was laid out, embalmed like an Egyptian mummy. To see him, you had to wait your turn. Making noise near Lenin's mausoleum was forbidden, but the Americans laughed and spoke in loud voices. The Americans and my mother were breaking the rules. Everyone in line was staring at my mom for shouting, but I was staring at the Americans. The Americans' clothes were in vibrant colors I did not know existed. They did not fit in Red Square at all. The square may be called red, but it is black and white in the winter. Most citizens in line were also dressed in black and white. Other colors were brown, army green, navy blue, and the red of our country's banner flapping above the mausoleum. Those were the colors of the Soviet rainbow. My family had come to Moscow to watch my older brother, Victor, compete in a figure skating competition. But Dad said that it was our patriotic duty to see Lenin's mummy first. No one in the long line was allowed to complain, except for my mother, of course. "What are you complaining about, citizen?" the security guard whispered to Mom. He looked nervous. He looked nervous that she was making a scene in the most sacred place in our country. "Complaining?" my mother shouted. "You didn't hear me complaining yet, young man. I demand to know your name and rank. Write it down, Victor. Who's in charge around here?" At last, the line began to move, and Mom, having left off a little steam, became perfectly calm. She took my hand, and we stepped into the mausoleum by the rules, in silence. The mausoleum was spooky inside. The stone walls reflected no light. And what light could they reflect? There was not a single light bulb anywhere. I rose on my tiptoes, hoping to glimpse the American colors up ahead. But a citizen's back blocked my view. The guards hurried us along the platform on which Lenin lay. I had never seen a dead person before, and this one had been dead since before I was born. "Don't be scared, Yevgeny," Dad whispered to me. "You love Grandfather Lenin." Lenin was grandfather to all Soviet children, which was a little confusing. So many children in our country? How could all of us have the same grandfather? I did not know, but it was better not to ask. Asking questions was considered not patriotic. I was 6 years old, and it was my first trip to the capital. While waiting in line, I had been looking forward to seeing Lenin's mummy, but with these vibrant Americans nearby, I suddenly was not so sure. Why did I have to look at Lenin anyhow? I knew his face better than I knew my own. Lenin stared at us from everywhere, from postcards and paintings, from banners and pins, from teapots, from money. His statue was in every square, his head and shoulders in every hallway. As for his name, streets, parks, and sports arenas were named after him. Even the city we lived in was called Leningrad. I shuffled by the mummy with my head turned away, but at the last moment, I could not help myself. I peeked. Lenin's face, glossy like fruit made of wax, glowed in the rosy spotlight. Just below his thin red beard, I saw a narrow strip of tape covered with paint, the color of the mummy's skin, but this close, still perfectly visible. Oh, why did I look? Lenin had a bandage under his beard. Chapter 2. I stumbled out of the mausoleum, hanging onto my mother's arm. Why did Lenin have a bandage? Could a mummy scratch itself? I wondered if I could ask Dad about it, but no. It definitely would not be patriotic to ask him such a question. The Red Square was only white now. It was snowing. Behind the snowflakes, the American colors were flashing toward their bus. The Americans would be gone in a minute. A picture of Lenin's bandage caked over with rosy paint appeared in my mind. The color made me ill. Why did we have to stay in line all day to see someone like that? Why did we have to learn a poem at school with the line, "Lenin is more alive than all the living"? And why could these Americans take one quick peek at Lenin and board their bus and go home and never have to see the mummy and its bandage again? Why? I could not ask anyone, but a crazy idea shot through my head. If we ran fast now, my family could get on that bus to America, too. Instead of us running, a young American, turquoise at the bottom, canary yellow at the top, those were his clothes, sprung toward us. His color sparkled so brightly in the falling snow that he seemed to float. And I wondered if our Soviet force of gravity did not apply to Americans. He was yelling at us in his language. "What is he saying?" Mom demanded of Dad. To the American, she said, "Parlez-vous français?" Dad's face turned banner red. "Verboten. Understand? Go away." "Juicy fruit! Juicy fruit!" The American thrust something into my brother's hand. "Give it back at once, Victor," Dad said. "Say thank you, Victor," Mom said. I was staring at the narrow strip of glossy wrapper in my brother's hand. The same shape as Lenin's bandage, but of the brightest yellow. I could not take my eyes off of it. But somehow I also saw men running at us from all directions and knew without being told that they were secret policemen disguised as regular citizens. The American saw them too. He turned around and bolted toward the bus. All at once, it got dark. A circle of men in black overcoats had closed around us. "What did he give you?" one said to Victor. The yellow wrapper disappeared into my brother's pocket. "Leave my son alone," Mom shouted. "Excuse me?" the man said to Mom. "No, young man, you will not be excused. Permitting foreigners to cut in line to see our beloved Lenin? Outrageous. Your superiors will hear from me. You can be certain of that. Step aside, citizens. My son is expected at a national figure skating competition." "Figure skating, yeah, right," the secret policeman said. "Get out of here before I lock you up, you filthy yids." "What are yids?" I asked my brother as Dad hurried us away. "That's what some people call Jews," Victor said. "We're Jews. Don't you know anything?" I did not care. Being called a filthy yid did not matter to me at that moment. What mattered was the stick of American chewing gum in my brother's pocket. No chewing gum was sold in our country, for a good reason. We barely had stuff to eat, let alone stuff to chew that you could not swallow. For 3 weeks afterward, Victor chewed on that stick of juicy fruit. Nights, he soaked the chewing gum in a cup of tea to keep it soft. By the time I inherited the gum, it had neither taste nor smell. Still, it was better than what I used to chew while pretending to be an American. Black chunks of tar left over from street paving. The tar was so hard, I broke a tooth on it once. Chapter 3. Russia was called the USSR at that time, or the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. If you think the name was long, take a look at it on the old Soviet map. 1/6 of the world was painted red just to make the name fit. Those old maps were made to trick our enemies. In case a foreign army invaded us, it would get lost. Lakes and forests on the map were drawn incorrectly on purpose. Rivers flowed in the wrong directions. Mountains were missing. The Soviet borders ran for so many miles that when the sun rose at one end, it was already setting in the other. No matter how vast our borders were, they were so perfectly guarded that nobody could sneak in. Nobody could sneak out either. My brother told me that leaving the USSR for a trip to a foreign country was forbidden, unless you were an important government official or had a terrific talent for something. "I bet you didn't even know we lived behind the curtain," Victor said to me once. I pictured a huge curtain made of iron hanging along our borders. "Sure I did," I said. "What is the Iron Curtain?" "Not what you think," he said. Victor told me that the Iron Curtain was not a curtain at all, but a bunch of friendly countries along our western borders. To keep our neighbors friendly, Soviet Army tanks loaded with ammunition and ready for action were stationed right inside their countries. Our tanks scared everybody, not only our friends, but also those who lived across the ocean, our enemies. "It's the Americans," Victor said. "It's their fault we live behind the Iron Curtain." "Why?" I said. "We're at war with them now. Only it's not a real war. It's mostly talk. That's why they call it a cold war. But in my opinion, it's not even that cold. It's lukewarm." "So why do they call it cold then?" "Because it's not hot. Don't you get it? The Americans and us built so many nuclear bombs. Well, geez, there's no point in having a war. That would be a hot war then. Would you want that?" Victor told me that instead of fighting a hot war, our government was carrying out strategic strikes by sending the most talented athletes and dancers to foreign countries to prove to the Americans that we are better than them. I'm going for sure, he said. Going where? To foreign countries. I have a talent for sports, Victor said. I'll be a figure skating champion. I knew that he would. He had won that competition in Moscow. Chapter 4. Because Leningrad is not that far from the Arctic Circle, our winters were perfect for sore throats, nasty colds, and pneumonia. Before I was allowed outside in the winter, Mom swaddled me in layers of itchy wool. Thermal underwear, padded pants, felt boots, sweaters, scarves, mittens. I could hardly move. When Mom tied the flaps of the fur hat under my chin, I could not hear either. Deaf, bulky, and nearly blind, I was told to go outside and play with the other children. Look, it's Yelchin, one of the Russian boys, having fun in the snow, would yell and pitch a snowball in my direction. I was an easy target, but my itchy armor protected me from their attacks. After my brother explained to me about the war with the Americans, I began to think of our courtyard as the Cold War battlefield, and my mother's swaddling was my personal iron curtain that kept me safe from the enemy. Chapter 5. The best thing about the Cold War was that Americans had plenty of their own talent with which to strike back at us. Their mightiest weapons were movie stars and rock stars. Once a week, my brother would take me to the tiny movie theater inside the Kirov's Palace of Culture to watch American movies. The movies were old and scratchy because they used to belong to the Germans until we beat them in World War II, or the Great Patriotic War, as we called it. That was why every movie began with a shaky card that looked like this. And it reads, "This film was captured as a military trophy after the defeat of the German Nazis in the Great Patriotic War for our motherland." The German translations of what the American actors said in the movies popped up at the bottom of the screen. The translations were useless. Victor and I did not know German, but amazingly, the Americans in the movies spoke Russian. "They dubbed the Americans into Russian," Victor once whispered to me in the dark, "so they won't say something bad about our country." I did not care. I was not interested in what the Americans had to say. I did not follow their stories. Tap dancing and slipping on banana peels seemed sort of silly. All I wanted to know was what that mysterious universe called the United States of America looked like. Even though that universe was in black and white like ours, it looked nothing like Russia. Chapter 6. Even better than movies was American rock and roll. But you could not hear it on the radio, and you could not buy American records in stores. The first time I heard rock and roll, it was on a record some Russian fellow made in his apartment. My brother brought the record home, but it did not even look like a record. It was an old X-ray photograph of someone's broken leg with a pea-sized hole burned in the center. A bunch of concentric grooves spread out from that hole like rings in a puddle after you toss a rock. My brother slapped the X-ray on the turntable, and when the broken leg began to spin, he dropped the needle and cranked up the volume. I had never heard anything like it. I could not tell a single musical instrument besides a drum, and I could not understand a word of what the singer was yelling, but it was better than the Red Army chorus on the radio, better than my mother's ballet music records. It was a riot. I loved it. "What is this music?" Grandma said. "Mashugana like you, this music." "What's Mashugana, Grandma?" Victor asked. "Crazy! What else could such noise be? Crazy! Let me hear it again." Grandma, Victor, and I listened to that x-ray for hours. We did not know the name of the song or who sung it, but we could not get enough of it. The code name for such records was Bones, because they were illegally recorded on x-ray pictures. They were in huge demand in Leningrad, but our government had already had a special law against them called groveling before the West. Making and selling bones was illegal, and if we were caught, Victor said, we could all go to prison. Maybe that was why, when Dad came home from work, he said, "The Communist Party of the Soviet Union continues to defeat the tireless propaganda efforts of the United States of America," and threw the bones into our wood-burning cook stove. Grandma, Victor, and I put up a riot worse than any rock and roll band, forcing Dad to pull the x-ray out of the fire. But the x-ray was so warped from the heat that we could not play it on the turntable anymore. But it played inside my head for weeks. Chapter 7. With all the space to spread out in our enormous country, Mom, Dad, Grandma, Victor, and I were allowed to live in one tiny room. There were other rooms in our apartment, but other families occupied those rooms. The kitchen, the hallway, and the bathroom were all considered communal spaces, and we shared them with other tenants. Living quarters like ours were called communal apartments, or communalkas for short. Each communalka had its own spy. Most of them were paid to spy, but some spied for free to be useful to our country. Our spy was Blinov. He lived by himself in the room next to us and spied on, eavesdropped, and reported on other tenants to the Committee for State Security, also called the KGB for short. The KGB wanted to know if any of our citizens were unhappy. And if they were, what was the reason? It must have been hard for Blinov to find out, because our tenants never complained when he was around. They never even said KGB in their regular voices, but in whispers, as if it was a terrible secret. Not once did I see Blinov leave the apartment. He sat in the corner of the kitchen, hidden behind the hallway door. You only knew that he was there by the tobacco smoke puffing up to the ceiling and by the tip of his slipper swinging in and out from behind the edge of the door. My brother said that not everyone had to share communalkas with spies. Our important government officials and most talented citizens were allowed private apartments. Even though my parents did not know any important government officials, my mother had plenty of talented citizens for best friends. Chapter 8. Mom worked at the Vaganova Ballet Academy, where children were taught to become great ballet dancers. The academy was named after the famous ballerina, Agrippina Vaganova. But Mom, always in a hurry, called the academy the Vaganovka for short. The Vaganovka is the greatest classical ballet institution in the world, Mom would say with pride. Mikhail Borzhnikov is a former student. Mikhail Borzhnikov was the greatest Russian ballet dancer. He was allowed a private apartment, a personal car, and trips to foreign countries. Mikhail Borzhnikov danced for the Kirov Ballet Theater, which my mother also called the greatest classical ballet institution in the world. Citizens stood in line for hours to buy tickets to the Kharov. But often, by the time they reached the box office window, all tickets were sold. Fortunately, there were always shifty characters loitering behind the box office that had extra tickets to sell to see Berezhnikov dance. Those tickets cost 10 times the regular price of admission. My mom's job at the Vagnovka was to make sure that her students cast in the Kharov's ballets knew their parts, were costumed, made up, and entered and exited the stage as instructed. Because of her job, Mom never had to stay in line to see Berezhnikov dance. The Kharov's special entrance for dancers, ballerinas, and orchestra musicians was always wide open to her. Mom was so well known in the world of classical ballet, I was convinced that she used to be a famous ballerina. When Mom's hands were free of grocery bags, frying pans, or sewing needles, she held her arms in what, in classical ballet, is called the preparatory position. Palms turn inward, close but not touching, elbows rounded, so there is plenty of room in between the arm and the armpit. But it was not just her arms. Mom turned her feet out in a straight line called the first fundamental position of the feet. She walked in that position with such incredible speed that I had to jog to keep up beside her. I have often wondered if Mom kept herself in preparatory position in case a chance turned up to dance. A pas de deux with Berezhnikov. A pas de deux is two dancers dancing together. Like everything in classical ballet, it's in French. Mom knew all the words. When she thought that I might have to go to the toilet, she would ask me in French. That would not be half as embarrassing had Mom's voice not been so terrifically loud. You could hear her ask me if I needed to pee-pee or caca from two blocks away. Chapter 9. The first time my mother took me to see Berezhnikov dance, I must have been 10 or 11. A grown-up man hopping around in tights was the last thing I wanted to see. But when Mom put on her prettiest green velvet dress, I changed my mind. She would only wear that dress on special occasions, and I thought we would sit in front row seats. But I was wrong. With Mom, ballet was strictly backstage. As always, Mom was in a hurry. We flew in through the Kharov's special entrance, up the steps, past the fireman in a brassy helmet asleep under the forbidden sign, and into total darkness, where the invisible orchestra was tuning their incredibly loud instruments. Mom kept her feet in the first position and zipped right through the dark, where mysterious things whooshed up and down and wheeled around us. Everyone we passed was in a terrible hurry like Mom. The curtain was about to go up, but they all took time to tell her that she looked fabulous in forest green. Proud to be with a fabulous-looking mother, I wanted to say that Mom made the dress herself out of an old ballet curtain, painted to look like a forest. But I was not sure if she wanted her talented friends to know that. "We'll be watching Berezhnikov from the wings," Mom shouted over the blaring orchestra and whisked me into a narrow path between two dusty drapes. The curtains flew up. A flock of ballerinas tiptoed into the dazzling stage. They smiled at us and said, "How do you do?" as they passed where Mom and I were standing. The ballerinas left a cloud of powder in their wake. I watched how prettily the powder swirled in the light beam and missed the ballerinas' dance. The audience clapped. The ballerinas rushed back, drenched in mud-colored sweat that ran down their faces, necks, and shoulders. "Isn't it marvelous?" Mom shouted. I was not so sure. The wings were dark as a cave and hot as an oven. The drapes were so full of dust that I was choking. And why were there no chairs? For ballet, you need strong legs, but for watching ballet from the wings, you need legs of iron. A terrifically loud bang from the orchestra punched me so hard in the belly that I doubled over and would have missed Baryshnikov's entrance had Mom not screamed, "Misha!" into my ear. Russia's greatest ballet dancer leaped from behind a fluff of ballerinas and, smiling, soared incredibly high into the air inside the cone-shaped light. "Grand jeté from fifth position," shouted Mom. I wanted Baryshnikov to land, but the spotlight seemed to hold him afloat in the swirling dust motes. I looked at my mom. Her hands were clasped under her chin as if she were praying. Her eyes sparkled with tears. "Oh, Misha," she gushed at Baryshnikov, and, looking at me, added, "I wish you were born with such artistic talent, Yevgeny." The audience leaped from their seats, shouting, "Bravo!" and flinging bouquets at smiling Baryshnikov. Well, that was the end of Chapter 9. I have been reading from The Genius Under the Table by Eugene Yelchin, and Eugene actually did grow up in Russia, and he's describing his childhood in this story, and it's really interesting, I think, to compare, right, what it's like to live with different amounts of questions, being able to ask questions, and different amounts of freedom. And different amounts of feeling like you can do what you want and not be judged, right? Or spied on. Oh my goodness, folks. We live in such an abundant world. I think it is really important for us to realize that there is enough for us to share and to remember that there are lots of people who are ready to share and ready to be free, like Eugene, who did make it to the U.S. and did discover what his special talent is. I hope you'll read the book someday.
We're rushing around in Russia, but we stopped to say hello. Dobre utra. Good morning. Dobre utra. Good morning. Then we were soon on the go. We were rushing around in Russia during the middle of the day. Dobre den. Good afternoon. Dobrý den. Good afternoon. Then we hurried on our way. We were rushing around in Russia during a star-filled night. Dobrý večer. Good evening. Dobrý večer. Good evening. Then we were quickly out of sight.
This is a story of a dishwashing man. The dishwashing man, he never saw a dish that he didn't understand. The dishwashing man is a hard-working man. No matter how high the pile he can. When the dishwashing man was a dishwashing boy, he dishwashed his way from Wichita to Troy. In the dishwashing days of the great Midwest, the dishwashing boy put some hairs on his chest. At a Hojo's in Tulsa, he refined his craft. But when it comes to getting paid, the dishwasher gets the shaft. So he earned a promotion to a busboy position. After two sorry weeks, he found himself wishing he was a dishwashing man, a dishwashing man. He never saw a dish that he didn't understand. The dishwashing man, he's a hard-working man. No matter how high the pile he can. So back to the suds, our hero went. To the comforting scent of detergent. But despite his skill, he got no respect. A manager'd walk by in a huff and expect a raid. On dishwashing man, on dishwashing man. He never saw a dish that he didn't understand. The dishwashing man is a hard-working man. No matter how high the pile he can. Over many a year and many a mess, the dishwasher proved he could dishwash with the best. But all the abuse finally took its toll. It weakened the resolve in the dishwasher's soul. It was out in Kansas City when it all fell through. He loved a young waitress with a nice hairdo. But she broke his heart and it led him to drink. The dishwasher's fortunes went right down the sink. It didn't take long before he lost his job. And without honest work, the dishwasher was just a slob. He lost his pride, a sense of his own worth. Turned his back on the calling for which he'd taken birth. He ate like a pig and he drank like a fish. The dishwasher feared that he'd washed his final dish. But then one day, the good Lord willeth that a pan be soiled with unspeakable filth. An entire kitchen staff tried to get the pan clean. They fought it and they cursed it, but the pan was just as mean. Then up spoke an old timer who said he heard tale of a dishwashing man whose efforts never failed. And that was the dishwashing man, the dishwashing man. He never saw a dish that he didn't understand. The dishwashing man is a hard-working man. No matter how high the pile he can. So they rushed over to the telephone directory. They got to the M's, looked up man, comma, D. But when they heard his weary voice, they thought he was a loafer. He said, "Don't you worry, boys, I'm coming right over." Well, 2 months later, he finally staggered to the scene with Cheetos on his teeth and bacon in between. He let out a belch, scratched himself and cussed. In the dishwasher's hair were cigarette butts and crust. Now pot scrubbing Pete, he spoke right up. He said, "We're looking at a man who's all dishwashed up." But the dishwashing man, he just said, "Let me through. There's scum on that pan and there's something I can do. 'Cause I'm the dishwashing man, the dishwashing man. I never saw a dish that I didn't understand. A dishwashing man is a hard-working man. No matter how high the pile he can." Well, he labored and he scrubbed and he gave it all he had. 'Cause he wanted that pan and he wanted it bad. After nearly a week, he finally emerged. But the townsfolk still wondered, should we cheer or sing a dirge? Then pot scrubbing Pete walked back to the dish drain. Saw a vanquished pan without a single stain. Well, the cheer rang out through Kansas City that night. But the dishwashing man, he shuns the limelight. So he slipped out the door, passed up his reward. Strolled through the parking lot and climbed into his Ford. But on the face of the dishwasher, you couldn't miss the grin. Now the dishwashing man, he's out there dishwashing again. Yeah, he's the dishwashing man. He's the dishwashing man. He never saw a dish that he didn't understand. A dishwashing man is a hard-working man, no matter how high the pile he can.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that shout out to dishwashers. I was actually just vacuuming myself, running the vacuum cleaner, and I've recently had somebody tell me that I'm a very good cleaner. Actually, I've had a few people tell me, actually, because I've been doing a lot of cleaning lately, that I'm a very good cleaner, and I'm very proud of that, right? That's a special talent. Washing dishes is a special talent. We all have special talents. Special talents are abundant. Thankfully, each and every one of you amazing, amazing human beings out there have special talents. And it's especially helpful if we are free to be ourselves, free to ask questions and explore things, and, just free to be you and me. And that's when we discover our special talents. And so I think it's really sad if people are growing up in places where there's not enough. And not enough food, not enough room for everybody to live and have enough space and a happy home. Because really, that's a lie. That's not true. There is abundance. We can all share with each other, right, guys? We do have enough if we share and if we are free to be who we are and give what we have and make more for everybody and follow our talents. It's our talents that make us abundant. It's being free to be who we are and to be together and to take care of each other. And so I hope you enjoyed our story today. We did a little traveling to Russia so that we could see what it was like for Eugene to grow up where he did. And he does discover his special talent in the story. So I hope that you will read The Genius Under the Table. We only read the first few chapters here today. And that was by Eugene Yelchin. And this is Amy's Kids Show. And we are just about out of time for today. I'm going to have to figure out what we're going to celebrate next week. But in the meantime, I'm going to be celebrating you. And I hope you are celebrating you, because you are amazing. Take every opportunity you have to ask questions and learn and protect each other, not spy on each other. That's crazy. Let's protect each other and make sure we all have the freedom we need to be ourselves. You're the greatest. Have a wonderful week, folks. I'll see you next time.